It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm Shelley Brisbane, your host. Welcome back for another discussion of a classic film, this one by popular demand of some of the panelists who are here and some of the panelists who didn't even make the show because we had so many people who wanted to talk about this movie, and that's always exciting. I have four great guests with me, some new, some not so new to the show, and let me introduce them to you before we get started. First up, brand new to Lions, Towers, and Shields, and it's nice to meet you also, Paul Saborin. Hi.
Hello. I'm very glad to have made the cut, apparently.
You did. Well, especially because you were new. I want people who haven't been on the show to have a chance to join the fun. So thank you for coming. Next up, and I call her my own personal Katharine Hepburn expert because that's how she and I met as fans of Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy years ago. And she knows more than anybody else I can think of about that subject. It's Judy Samuelson. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. So we're going to be talking about Midnight Cowboy, right?
You first.
Plot's basically the same, honestly.
It's a couple of I don't even have a good Midnight Cowboy Philadelphia story joke. That is never something I thought I'd have to say. Next up, also a returning visitor to the show, it's Mickey Maynard. Hi.
Hi. I'm going to behave myself naturally.
I love that line so much. And last but not least, and only last because I want her to plug a show that's also here on the Incomparable Network, The Agents of Smooch, where we'll be cross-posting this very podcast because we here at Lions, Towers, and Shields have a lot of simpatico with our friends at Agents of Smooch, which is a podcast all about romance from many forms and many eras. It's the director of The Agents of Smooch, Annette Weirstra. Hi.
Hello, Agent Shelley. It's always fun to do crossovers with you because usually when we're watching, I'm watching romances with you of this era. I haven't seen them, which is the case of this. I just want to say that I have a new mantra. You know, wine never affects me. I'm going to say that all the time. It does. But yes, Agents of Smooch, we talk about romance in all of its forms. And so last summer when we did our travel movies, we did crossover of a couple Audrey Hepburn travel movies, which was very fun. And so when we're doing wedding season this year, we thought this movie would be perfect. And it is. So I'm really excited to talk about romance with you.
Annette plans her shows. She has a spreadsheet. She knows months in advance what she's going to do. I like being part of Annette's team. I really do. And she gets me to watch things I never would otherwise watch, but I'm always happy to say, of course I'll try that because of the nice people that I get to hang out
with.
Well,
and I feel the same about Lions, Towers, and Shields because I don't watch a lot of older movies, especially like this old. And, you know, my old movies are like I'm rewatching things from the 1990s or 80s. So this is always fun to go back in time a little further. And every time I watch one, I'm like, I should watch more movies from this era because they're so
slowly
good.
But surely, so, yes. We're indoctrinating new people into the classic film.
Well, I think style. I said to you, I recognize the director, which means you are getting into my brain.
Well, and we will get to that very shortly because we've talked about films directed by George Cukor before, and there's a lot of connective tissue between this movie and Holiday, which we did way back at the very beginning of Lions, Towers, and Shields, and The Women, which, as you hear this, we just did last time on Lions, Towers, and Shields. Philadelphia Story, made in 1940 by MGM, starring the great Katharine Hepburn, Cary Grant, and James Stewart, directed by George Cukor, who had infamously or famously been fired from Gone with the Wind, but he... That's funny because when you read about this movie... That's one of the things you read, that just happened to George Cukor and that Katharine Hepburn was just box office poison. And so it's like these people clawing their way back. I don't think it was quite like that. It's a little bit dramatic, but Cukor did have a hand in, you know, big costume pictures like Gone with the Wind, as well as a lot of pictures that were called, quote unquote, women's pictures. He was definitely a romance director. And he was also a favorite of Katharine Hepburn. They worked together 10 times. This is including her first film, Bill of Divorcement. This is about halfway through the number of films that they worked on together. He also directed, as I said, Holiday, which also starred Cary Grant. Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn made 4 films together, and this is the last one of those. And so getting the band back together seems to work for Kate and for the rest of these folks as well. Judy, do you want to talk a little bit about how Philadelphia Story, the film, came to be? Because Katharine Hepburn had a lot to do with making it happen. She had started in the play by Philip Barry. And Philip Barry also wrote Holiday, by the way. But the story of how it came to be a film is pretty interesting.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that I totally am answering what you're thinking, but you know, in the late 30s, or actually mid 30s, when Hepburn had gone from, like, you know, great heights to being proclaimed box office poison, with a number of insignificant people like Joan Crawford and Fred Astaire and Marlene Dietrich, she started production of Jane Eyre, and I think it was 1937, toured in it with the thought of bringing it to Broadway. It was a Theatre Guild production. She worked with them often, but ultimately it was a mutual decision that this was not going to be the play that was going to bring her back to public favor. And Philip Barry had been a friend of hers. I think her earliest experience with him was where she was hired for, but I think then fired for, the Animal Kingdom in the early 30s. And she understudied the part that she eventually played in the movie of Holiday when it was in the theater. And so they had been friends. And he came to her with this idea of a play. A lot of people say it was based on her. Probably a lot of the mannerisms, the character of Tracy Lord, was based on her, but it was really based on another sort of mainline woman that he knew, Hope Montgomery. She agreed to do the play. It was, again, for the Theatre Guild, with her and Joseph Cotten and Van Heflin and Shirley Booth. And, you know, it was a great success, but she played it on Broadway and then toured with it. Then, of course, the thought was that the MGM would buy and put one of its leading stars in it, like Norma Shearer or anyone else that was in their stable. And at the time, Hepburn was no longer seeing, but was a friend of Howard Hughes. He purchased the rights for her, so that she could go to MGM armed with the rights to the play or to the film, and you know, sort of make her own laws, decisions about you know, who would star in it with her, and that's what she did, and that was her first film in Metro. The story is that she originally wanted Spencer Tracy and Clark Gable in the roles that Jimmy Stewart and Cary Grant eventually played. Do too bad with the two of them. And I know Cary Grant wanted top billing, which, of course, at that point, he was a bigger star than she was, or a more popular star than she was, I'll say. And he got it, and he donated his salary to the British War Relief. And that was it. I mean, and then she sort of never looked back in terms of her popularity and her stardom at Metro.
And she made a bunch of money from selling the film rights, as well as getting a really high salary, as did Grant. And Jimmy Stewart, who was working at MGM, was just like getting his regular studio wage, which probably wasn't terrible, but it wasn't $75,000 to star in the movie.
Well, Cary Grant's was 150, 100
and some,
I believe.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And then so Hepburn got, you know, the money for the rights. So they made this big MGM production out of it. It was a smash hit. You know, unlike sometimes you see a movie from that era and you just think, oh, it must have been an enormous hit, like something like Bringing Up Baby, which was not. But this was a ginormous hit, which I guess had a lot to do with why Hepburn was no longer box office poison. But let's dig into the movie and let you guys, I'd love to hear, just let's go around, and what's your sort of overall feeling about the movie? Some of you have seen it more than once. Annette, I know, just saw it for the first time. But what's your take on this movie?
Well, I have to say I'm This is one of my favorite movies. This is on my top 10 list, and I have much of the dialogue memorized. And so I have a friend who also loves this movie, and we would greet each other, OCK Dexter Haven. So go around, literally, like, you know, someone could say, you know, oh, the butler's been in the sherry again, you know, and we just laugh our heads off hysterically because we know exactly what it is. So I actually saw the stage play, obviously not in 1939, but a production was mounted at the Henry Ford Museum Theater in Dearborn, Michigan. And of course, I wanted to see it because I loved the movie so much. And the stage play essentially took place in the living room. There was no other set than the living room. And I think when you see the movie and you see the use of this various mansions and the library and the rolling lawns and especially the swimming pool, that they really were able to expand on that original. It was literally a drawing room comedy. And I think it works much better as a film than it does as a stage play. But really, the Tracy Lord character to me, it's a little bit of an echo of Woman of the Year, because Katharine Hepburn, there was this feeling that she was, you know, so much on a pedestal that she had to be taken down a notch. And just so, just like in Woman of the Year, where there's that final scene where she, you know, the kitchen blows up, there's a constant kind of battering of Tracy throughout this movie. And I didn't really notice it until another friend watched it and said, why was everybody so mean to her? So it is a little bit misogynistic. And she does have to be taken down before she can end up with a happy ending. And that kind of jumps out at me now more than it did when I first saw the movie.
I may be an unpopular opinion, but I don't necessarily like agree 100% with that. Because with that idea, yes, everybody sort of blames her for their own failings. I mean, C.K. Dexter Haven became an alcoholic because she wasn't the perfect wife for him. Her father had an affair because he didn't have a loving daughter. So there are all those moments where she's taken sort of down, where her sort of excellence as a human being isn't appreciated. You know, I once interviewed Tyne Daly. This is totally like out of left field here, but I interviewed her about people claiming that when she did Cagney, were role models. And she said to me, an actor can't play a role model. They have to play a person with characteristics, with faults, with good points. And my view about, like, some Hepburn, the criticism always is that, you know, that she's being taken down. Tracy Lord, in my view, was being taken down a notch because she was sort of intractable. She wasn't a perfect a person. We look at her and we see Hepburn and you know, wonderful and but the character Tracy Lord wasn't like the most the easiest person to live with. What is the line? You'll know the line about her standards. You know, Tracy has very high standards and we can't always live up to them. I think she was playing a type of person in a class. I mean, the play and the movie are very class conscious. And that's who's taken down a peg. And I don't really see that as misogynistic. I see that as this specific character being humanized a little more, which now you can all disagree with me.
I think I'd probably come down somewhere in the middle on that. From my background on the movie, it's also a longtime favorite of mine. I watched it first back in college in the late 80s. And to get the sense of what this movie means to me, I'm a musician. And when you first join a rights organization like ASCAP or BMI, to oversee like the publishing of any music that you put out, you have to choose a name for your publishing company. And the name of my publishing company is C.K. Dexter Haven Music.
Oh, nice.
But yeah, I mean, it's a little hard, you know, it's certainly hard to know for sure actual attitudes at the time of the public and of Hollywood versus what's written with a lot of hindsight and or bias, the extent to which people, you know, genuinely disliked Hepburn herself or not. It is interesting to me that she chose, you know, the part was written for her. She chose this play and she chose this as her re-entry into Hollywood. So it's not like she was unfamiliar with how the character was being presented as this sort of brittle person. Maybe not brittle is not, maybe not the right word, but this intractable person with, shall we say, high standards, who gets not brought low, but certainly taken down a peg in some ways. You know, I can't imagine she'd be unaware of the way that was seen. And it took similar multiple viewings on my part to really sort of come to terms with the sexual politics of a lot of the movie. Like, just as was noted, like her Seth Lord, her father, essentially, first of all, saying that, you know, men's affairs and dalliances have nothing whatsoever to do with their wives or families, which is some wonderful deflecting. And also his whole monologue about how, essentially, because my daughter didn't love me enough, I went to go seek a young woman to make right. me to make me not feel old, which is also, you know, it's a line of crap.
That made me gasp. I was like, what?
Yeah.
And even with Cary Grant's character, as you were saying, you know.
Yeah, but I think as an audience, you're supposed to gasp. I don't think you're supposed to say, yeah, Seth Lord, you're right. You know,
that's tough. That's one that's tough for me to judge how much of that is a product of the times, so to speak, versus how much of it is intentional and supposed to make him look bad. I'm genuinely not sure. Like, he doesn't appear to get any sort of comeuppance or consequences for that. At the end of the movie, he, you know, his wife has taken him back and they appear to still have this loving relationship, and there's not a lot of nuance to it. There doesn't seem to be any sort of great consequences to him. He tells his daughter it's at least partly her fault that he had an affair, and at the end she tells him how much she loves him. But that said, you know, I don't think the whole movie is, you know, let's take down this uppity woman for having the temerity of not constantly being deferential to the men in her life. But there's, you know, there's some troubling stuff in there. Like you were saying before, like Cary Grant, somewhat, if not blaming his alcoholism on Tracy Lord, at least saying that she was in no way any help, and her lack of affection just made him be that much worse of an alcoholic, which again is, it's easy with hindsight of, you know, 80, 90 years, you know, we know a lot more about alcoholism and the causes of these sorts of things, but there's more
of that in the play. There's more of a direct reference to that in the play, but I mean, they don't overplay it, but it is sort of mentioned that, you know, he couldn't take that marriage anymore, and he started drinking.
Okay.
I know it's weird, but
yeah.
I want to get Annette in here, especially since she's our first timer, because I have feelings on all the things we're talking about too. But
well, in the light of that, so I am new. I have no feelings coming into this, other than I'd heard how great it was. But when, like, I found that in contrast to Tracy being set up as this, like, aloof, intractable character, you have two men in her life being George and C.K. Dexter Haven, which is such a good name. They are both putting her on a pedestal from a different angle, I think, which kind of like she lifts herself up, but they also make her into like calling her a goddess and, you know, sort of lamenting that she's this untouchable goddess. Well, then you're not. She says, I want to be loved, like really loved, not admired. And like, you know, so he's creating, I saw that as he's creating distance, and they both are creating this situation where they're not connecting on the personal level. They're kind of idealizing her, that, you know, that makes it really hard to have a relationship. And then George is kind of trying to do the same thing and trying to set her up as the perfect wife, but he doesn't see her. Whereas I see CK actually does see her, even though he sort of elevates her, and George really sees her and wants her to be the perfect political wife, but hopefully he's hoping. And, you know, and that ultimately is what is the failure of their relationship is he finally realizes and she realizes that it's not going to work. But spoiler. Yeah. But yeah, I just couldn't see that. She would never be, I can never make you happy, because she was never going to be that perfect wife who just has like, does nothing other than be the perfect.
Be an accessory.
Yeah, exactly. She's just there to like hang off his arm and help him with his political career. And she has the right credentials.
The thing with her father, I have trouble reconciling that, because I do feel like he directly blames her for the affair that he had. And I think her sin in that relationship is that she didn't invite him to the wedding, which I think you could argue about. One of the arguments against inviting him was that it would hurt her mother. One of the arguments for it is he's your dad. Let him come and tell him not to bring his girlfriend or whatever it is. But that seems to be Tracy's primary offense in terms of C.K. Dexter Haven's drinking. And you have to say the whole name. At least I feel like I have to.
You really do.
I don't know him well enough to call him CK. But in terms of his drinking, remember that he stops. He talks about, you know, she says how disgusting his drinking was. And there's a point later in the movie. And when, you know, everybody else around them is drinking, Dex is like, not drinking right now. And so he understands the fault in his own behavior. You get the sense that as they get back together, spoiler alert again, that he's changed. It's not just her that's changed. Whereas in terms of her relationship with her father, she's had to change, it's a conversation that you'd probably have in a more modern movie where the mother might say, you know what, I'm willing to take him back, or I'm willing to take him on the terms that he's willing to take me. And you may not like it, but that's the choice that I've made. Whereas the mother in all this, they don't have that conversation.
Yeah, I think maybe a movie that was made 30, 40, 50 years later might have been more likely to have had that sort of scene of sort of giving the mother her due. Like, yes, I'm going to take him back, and you may disagree with it, but it's my life and it's my relationship and it's my decision. And it might have given her a little more agency in that regard. Maybe less so with a, you know, sort of light drawing room comedy in 1940 or in the late 30s on stage.
The other thing that's interesting about Tracy's character is that the way that I see her moving through the world and the way that the men who are involved with her describe her is really different, because they do all this sort of goddess thing. And I guess that's the way they see her, because she's beautiful and she's statuesque and she is, you know, has manners and all of those things that would make one, you know, a desirable female partner. And they apply the word goddess. To me, like, the things that Tracy does, the thing about human frailty that her father says, that's a good knock on her. I mean, she does seem to be unable to adapt to human frailty. She has her response to Dexter being a drunk is, I'm not going to deal with it. We're not actually clear what she does other than say it's disgusting. Her response to her father is, don't come to my wedding. And so that's harsh, but that's really different than, in my relationships with men, I expect to be worshipped. I don't get from her that that's her expectation. And you're right, that in the dialogue she says, I want to be loved, which was probably always true. And she probably feels like she's not able to communicate to her partner in a way that would lead to the outcome that she wants.
But she says that directly after Dexter has that whole speech with her at the pool. Yeah. You know, I think you're right, though. We don't really know her. We're told that she's this arrogant person who can't recognize human frailty, but we don't really see it in her. We see it, that opinion of her, through the eyes of all the different people, and but we don't necessarily see that, I don't think, in terms of the Jimmy Stewart character's eyes. He just doesn't like her initially because of, you know, where she comes from. And, you know, she's got a South Parlor and she's, you know, she's an upper class, very, very upper class, you know, person. He doesn't have any patience for that silliness and that whatever. And then, you know, as soon as they have the talk about his book, he starts to see her in a different light, and you start to see her in a little bit of a different light. I mean, yes, then she offers him, you know, to be a patron of the arts, and he turns her down. But everything we see about her, we're told that she's, you know, this ice goddess, you know, but only by all the men in her life. And maybe she probably, you know, the men in her life are sort of, they're so different. Maybe they're right. I mean, the only one who doesn't necessarily view her that way, obviously, is George, because he's kind of adult and that's what he's looking for himself. You know, he wants that status and he wants that, you know, he's a new money person and they're old money and he wants in.
I think actually George admires her quite a lot, probably not for the right, certainly not for the right reasons. But I think George's understanding of her is significantly less than either of the other two men at any point in their relationship. Even mm-hmm. when they were married, mm-hmm. C.K. Dexter yeah. Haven knew her a lot better than George did on the day they were going to get married.
Yeah, well, I mean, think of it. This is like this romantic comedy, right? I mean, we're getting all serious about this, but I mean, you know, see, Dexter doesn't come back for no reason. I mean, obviously, we know the plot reasons that he comes back, but he's still in love with her, and he, or he still wants to be protective, and he loves the family, so he knows her probably better than anyone, and he wants her back. I think
there seems to be a few things missing in the plot, and obviously, we're looking at it from 2021 to 1940, but. What did she do? So she didn't have to do a profession, but how does she fill her time? She doesn't seem like an ordinary socialite. We know that she's funded the library or whatever, and that she does read books, but is there something that's her interest? And I don't know if that's ever really explained beyond the fact that, you know, she's Tracy Lord. The other thing is she and C.K. Dexter Haven never had any little havens. Why didn't they have any little havens? Was she the virgin goddess and got put off by him? Was he drinking too much and couldn't perform? I mean, that's a big question because it's 1940 and they're young, healthy people and women got pregnant on their honeymoon, you know? So why would she, and she's gorgeous, you know, why didn't she have kids by him? Does she want to have children by George? I'm not sure that that's ever made very clear either. She's got Dinah, her little sister, so maybe she doesn't feel a need for children. But there's just a few holes that I think would help round out her character beyond the ice cold person and explain a little bit why all these men fall in love with her beyond the superficial. And that might just be because it's 1940 and nobody felt a need to put it in there, but it's some couple questions I've always had about her character.
I was also it wasn't until this last rewatch that I noted how short the time period was, like not only just in the taking place of the events, it was just over the course of essentially 24 hours or so, but that in the sort of closing proxy monologue, they say 2 years ago you were cheated out of a wedding. So it was only 2 years ago that George and she first got married. Their marriage fell apart. He went off and got sober. She went off and met George, and now she's getting married again. I found it a remarkably short time span.
Well, because divorce took a while back then. It could have taken a full year to get a divorce.
Yeah, or
an annulment, which is possible if she.
Yeah.
Possible. There is an awful lot of talk about virtue in this movie. I've written a bunch of notes about that. But yeah, it seems like what might have happened is that C.K. and Tracy's marriage just burned really hot and then flamed out, except that you get the impression they've actually known each other for quite some time.
Well, they grew up together.
Yeah,
I mean, they joke that they grew up together, but it seemed to have also been true that they knew each other, you know,
right,
younger.
And so it's kind of interesting. I sort of wonder why the detail of that it's such a short marriage, because they're about 30. That's what they're playing. And you know, you could have just sort of let the notion of them having been married for like 5 years and then it fell apart. And also C.K. is, you know, Dinah is very attached to him. The whole family is very attached to him. It's not as if he's just some guy that nobody knew.
I just wanted to say that one parallel that I see, this might sound kind of wacky, but there's a little bit of Downton Abbey in this. And I would not put it past Julian Fellowes to have lifted, you know, threads from the Philadelphia story. But, you know, Mary Crawley madly in love with Matthew, but makes a wrong decision about, you know, accepting him when it looked like her mother was pregnant. Then she meets this Sir Richard Carlyle. I'm not afraid to be called a self-made man. And he calls her an ice goddess too. You know, the cold and careful Lady Mary Crawley who had the Turkish lover who died in her bed, you know, and she's pining away for Matthew the whole time. So that's, you know, if you look at the parallels between the two characters, they're both rich women and they're both brought down a little bit by different types of circumstances.
I feel like Philip Barry's knowledge of various strata of wealth is pretty significant and pretty specific, perhaps to that time period, because I feel like, and then Holiday is the same thing, where you feel like that there are sort of nuances of culture and nouveau versus old money that he plays with in a way that I think he either doesn't care that his audience doesn't know those details, or he figures it's a comedy, the masses will just sort of deal with it. But it does seem like there are strata in here that if you talk to Philip Barry, he could probably tease out in a way that I don't feel qualified to do.
Well, the debutantes and wealthy people during the 1930s were celebrities. Probably the 19, you know, so if you think about Brenda Fraser, who is the most famous debutante, and you think about Ouija and the photo that he took of the homeless ladies watching the ladies in their furs and diamonds go into a ball or whatever. I mean, these people were like, you know, celebrities today, like Kardashians and folks like that. And so people actually did follow the rich in great detail and probably owned etiquette books and things like that. So today we might not have the kind of knowledge of the social strata that people might have had 70 years ago because they didn't have anything else.
Look at the movies of the 30s are, granted it was, you know, I mean, depression time and everything. The movies of the 30s are like rife with, you know, the upper class, the rich, the, you know, I don't know, from everything from Dinner at Eight to
We talked about My Man Godfrey here. There are a lot of those movies. Yeah. I just feel like in Barry especially, there are nuances that he's probably trying to get across that would be interesting if you cared to make a study of that period and also of the rest of his work. I'd love to talk about the family because this is, you know, movie families are interesting because often it happens that you have people that are put together as a family who seem nothing alike. And then there are some families where you kind of get that they're all connected.
In the play, one of the reasons I love this movie so much, and it's a perfect example of what a really good screenwriter can do, Donald Ogden Stewart, he took the play, which I think when you see it now, like as it Mickey was saying, that, you know, it's a really it's sort of much more dated than the film is in my view. First of all, he took characters. There are characters in the play that aren't in the movie. He combined the character of C.K. Dexter Haven with Tracy's brother in the play. Tracy's brother, Sandy, is the one who, you know, brings the Macaulay Connor and Liz Imbri in because he's been sent this galley about the article that Kittredge is gonna run in his. It's interesting in the play, the magazine is Destiny, but Kittredge is also the publisher of a magazine called Spy. And he chose to use that for the movie. Why, I don't know. But there are just so many things that are streamlined that in a play, I guess you need more, you know, expository scenes than in a movie where you can just, you know, show the beginning scene of her, of, you know, him, you know, pushing her, breaking the golf club and pushing her down. And you get an immediate sense of what, you know, that was not a good match made in heaven at that point. But a lot of things like that have been sort of streamlined, and it makes the movie just so much more elegant, I think, than the play. aside from everything else we're talking about, it's like the sort of elegance of the screenplay and just the way the movie looks. I remember when they showed it, like a million, I mean, they show it all the time on TCM, but they showed it years ago with one of their guest presenters. I think it was Todd Oldham, the fashion designer, who just said it looked like it was shot on silk or satin, he said. And that's what it looks like to me. It's just a perfect example of MGM at its best. And it still looks incredibly good when you watch it, even on TV, forget about it in the movies. But anyway, I digress, Shelley. I'm sorry.
No problem. And yeah, I've seen it several times in a theater, and you're right. It's one of those movies that's worth seeing in a theater. And you sort of don't think that necessarily when you watch it on television, because it's not an epic. It's not a small comedy either, but there's the beauty of it on the big screen. And of course, Tracy's outfits are gorgeous. But what I wanted to say about the family is just how different they are as individuals and how important their interplay is. So you have Tracy and Dinah, who I adore Virginia Weidler. I adore her as Dinah.
She's wonderful.
I love her relationship with Tracy, which I find, because, you know, whatever you want to say about Tracy and her flaws as a human being, she loves her mother and she loves her sister. And they have this sparring relationship. Tracy never says, you know, Dinah, be a good girl, Dinah, do this. And Tracy's mother, who is, she's proper and she's polite and she's not a prig. She's not somebody who you feel like is a shrewish keeper of this mainline house. And so whatever their culture and their wealth and their family, you know, has done to them, their family dynamics, except for Dad playing around, seem to be pretty decent.
One moment with Dinah that I like is when she says something like, something must be about to happen because they're taking me away.
That sums up childhood.
She's a terrific little actress, but also some of her lines are, you know, she sits down to sing Lydia, Oh Lydia, and just steals the show right there. And it's good.
Oh, you know so what's good. You know what's funny in the movie early on when they're looking at all the gifts and she picks up that sort of atrocious kind of necklace and she goes, this stinks. In the play, her character is reading the galleys about the threatened article that's going to run about her father, and she says the line, "This stinks," after reading it, because she knows that it's going to cause trouble. But that's the kind of thing that Donald Ogden Stewart took, like and totally transformed into like a comic moment, without like sacrificing any of the plot at all. That's what I mean about like it, you know, not having things just laid out for you. You have to sort of do a little work when you watch the movie as opposed to the play. I feel that way too about, I hope I'm not offending anybody, because maybe someone here loves it, but I really don't like High Society, which is the musical version, partially for that reason. It just explains everything. You know,
we've actually talked about doing there's a thing we watched The Fountainhead a few months ago on Lions, Towers and Shields, and we called it a hate watch. And we're talking about doing a High Society hate watch. So if that gives you any sense of how the corporate Lions,
wine.
Towers and Shields. Yes, with wine. There has to be wine with a hate watch.
Yeah.
I too really love Virginia Weidler. And a lot of her line reads are just sort of preternaturally wonderful. My favorite line from her, which is just this beautiful, compact bit of exposition as well in its own way, is when she says, "My real name is Diana, but my sister changed
it." I love it so much.
It says so much about Tracy. It says so much about her that she just sort of went along with it, and the whole family went along with it, and it's beautiful. And she's not, it's not so much that she's naturalistic per se, but she seems more comfortable on screen, not to compare actors per se, but I always, whenever I watch this movie, I think about her performance in it compared to, say, a lot of screen performances of Margaret O'Brien, whom I also like a lot. Yep. I also like Margaret O'Brien a lot.
I knew,
but there is something
Margaret
a little
O'Brien.
Maybe it's just the vehicle she's in or something, but there was always something a little more actory, I guess, or child actory about Margaret O'Brien's performances that's just utterly missing from this one that I really resonates well with me.
I just watched The Women, and she's in that, and she's a couple, I don't know if she's, I want to say she's a couple years younger. The movies were released a year apart, so I don't know what her actual age was at filming time, but she seems a lot younger. The part is also younger because she has the role of being the long-suffering wife's daughter who also finds out about, you know, the fact that her father is having an affair and then ultimately marries Joan Crawford. Spoiler alert if you haven't seen The Women. And I couldn't help thinking about this movie because the reason I even can say Virginia Weidler's name is because of the Philadelphia story, because I remember, you know, looking it up and going, I have to find out who this kid is. And she was in a lot of MGM movies, but this is kind of, and she stopped after she was had been a child star. She didn't, you know, like go on.
And she died pretty young.
She did. She died for, I believe it was cancer or something like that. It wasn't one of those tragic child star deaths. I think she married and went out of the
business. No, she had a family. Yeah.
But this is really, to me, like the pinnacle of Virginia Weidler. But if you watch The Women, I just sort of feel like, oh, look what's coming for you, girl. This next part you have is going to be amazing.
I have this headcanon about her and C.K. Dexter Haven in that, because we already know Dinah likes him and is on Team Dexter. Yeah. And I feel like he knows this, and he also knows how, like, her curiosity and her sort of a little mischievousness, and he uses and sets her up in a lot of cases to sort of like play, like help him along with his plot to win Tracy back, which I perceived as the thing the whole time. Although for a minute there, I did think maybe Mike was gonna edge him out. But I see like the two of them together, and it's like she knows that he's setting her up, and he's setting her up, and then she just goes like, I gotcha, and then does what he's like implied and told her to do, which is really delightful. And it's like implied, I think, but also pretty, I thought it was pretty clear that those two were up to getting
things
in line.
She wants him back in the family. Also.
Exactly. Oh, so he sets it out. He lobs that ball over to her, and she just bats it right back at him. And, he, you know, no discussion or anything. This is not a plan, but she's just like smart enough to see what's happening and picks that up and runs.
She needs a father figure in her life, because not only is her father absent, but he's considerably older than Dexter is. What a great person to have as your father figure.
Right. And also, if you think about, the little one. I'm sorry, her name went right out of
Dinah.
My head. Dinah, sorry. So Dinah looks to be 10 or 12, don't we think? And if Tracy's 30.
Well, I thought about that, the difference.
She's the whoopsie baby. You know, she might have been like a reconciliation baby or something. And then either got sent off to school or just went to a girl's school, never saw her dad. Her sister marries this wonderful guy next door who pays attention to her. Probably one of the only adults who pays attention to her. And, you know, she really likes him. You know, he's not even a dad, but more of a big brother uncle kind of situation. So it's an interesting allyship to see in the movie. And I think it works really nicely because we like both of them a lot.
Mm-hmm. In the play, the Dinah is 15 and Tracy is 24. So, but still, when you think about it, Hepburn herself, I mean, you know, she was not so much with her brothers, but her sister, she was much older than
right.
them.
That's true.
You know, so she knew that relationship just as an actor, you know, with another actor. She knew that relationship. She had sisters that young, that you know, difference in age. Mm-hmm. But Virginia Weidler, I just think she's, you know, she just, you know, the kid who knows all, sees all, you know, she sees everyone for what they are. She, you know, she can read them right away. And you know, she's very necessary in that sense. You know, she gives away a lot of things, the whole after the swimming scene and everything. She, you know, she just talks about her dream. You know, she knows what she's doing, I think.
So when Annette and I were chatting about this movie, she said to me, and Annette, of course, doesn't live in old movie land like I do. So she said, is this pre-code? Because there's more to it than I expected in sex terms than in movies that are, you know, post pre-code. And of course, it's not
sex
pre-code.
And
it's,
drinking. You know, like, I mean, sex they're walking and, around.
Well, there's lots.
Drunk.
Right.
I don't know.
But the interesting thing about sex in this movie, and I it's one of those things that I notice more on rewatches, because there's not an infrequent sex plot in movies. Did they or didn't they? Did he deposit her in the bed and leave immediately? Is there a question about whether he took her virtue or whatever? That's pretty common. But the precursor to it, where all there's so much conversation, where I don't know another movie of the era where the word virgin is used so often, or virtue, or something that alludes to virtue, and then, you know, pretty frank foreplay in terms of what these people do. And obviously they're drunk, of course, but that gives them the freedom to loose their inhibitions. And it is sort of fascinating, because it doesn't feel scandalous to me, because I've seen it many times and the like. But the more I listen to the dialogue, the more interesting it is that there's so much sexual tension in this movie.
And you know what? One of my favorites, speaking of that, one of my favorite scenes is, you know, after Mike and CK are you know, plotting their article about Sidney Kidd and what's her name? Jimmy Stewart drives. Oh, who drives up with her?
No, it was.
No, she drives.
She Liz. What? Yeah,
it's
Liz drives up
it?
with Tracy in the passenger seat.
Right, and she get you know, Cary Grant. She get extra Haven. You know, looks at her sitting in the car, and yeah, Liz tells her that, you know, they've had an argument. She and George have had an argument, and he gets into the car, and he like, you know, he gets into the driver's side of the car, and he just like, you know, sidles up to her, and she's half asleep, and it looks like he looks like he's gotten into bed with her. I always felt it's a very romantic scene, and then she also sees who it is, and she's like, you know, I never drink, you know.
I believe they were once married in that scene. I absolutely do, because they've let their walls down for whatever reason. She's half asleep. It's late at night. They're both under stress of various kinds, but they're looking at each other and seeing each other as real people, and they're not performing in the way that they are in a lot of the other scenes.
I feel like Tracy has really good chemistry, and, you know, Katharine Hepburn, with both C.K. Mm-hmm. Dexterhaven and Mike. And so I didn't know what was going to happen. I could have seen either of those going. But it was like, it was kind of a nice interplay watching it for the first time, going, I don't actually know what's going to happen. I feel like they set me up in one direction, and now they're taking me off on this other tangent. And I just felt like they both, I liked how they were both sort of respectful of her and didn't really have a lot of competition, which could have been a thing. And they were both united in the fact that they didn't want her to marry George. But I felt like if, it was sort of like best man could win, but, and they didn't need to have like sort of that fight and tension and competitiveness between them. And they both, like, I liked that, you know, they both sort of were gentlemen and didn't push things further than she wanted to, especially when she was drunk. That's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Can I take a moment, mm-hmm. Not to completely segue, but when we're talking about chemistry, screen chemistry, and which, you know, just remarkable, just about every combination on screen in this movie, the actors just work so wonderfully well together. But can I particularly sing the praises of Ruth Hussey in this whole movie? The part of sort of the sassy mm-hmm. best friend, and or the sort of the friend of the male protagonist who loves him from afar but can't ever really express it or what have you, mm-hmm. can be such a thankless role in so many of these types of comedies. And she really just sort of rides the line of that while still being a very interesting and very funny and very smart character. And, you know, she's not, her whole existence isn't constantly built around her relationship with Mike. But I don't know. She just brought such wonderful
humanity. But she knows him. I mean, she really
knows
him.
Yeah, she absolutely knows him.
And she knows, you know, he'll get over this momentary infatuation. It's just, you know.
And
What was her line about the
I don't want to get in his way.
I love that line. I was like, I'll get him in the end, but he needs to grow up a little more.
Because first of all, the author gives her good lines. A character like that sometimes has a thankless job of being insulted most of the time, because why are you here? You're a third wheel. You're clearly no Katharine Hepburn. So, of course, Jimmy Stewart's going to be drawn to Katharine Hepburn and not you.
Yeah.
But she has wit, and she and Jimmy Stewart work together as a team in that sense, and she gets to say good things. And yeah, the character doesn't seem to be pining, even if I think there are moments at which she's unsure whether she's going to get Mike in the end, but I think she also knows enough for her relationship and also just as a human not to freak out.
You see that brief look on her face at the very end when when Mike asks Tracy to marry him, you see it momentarily. And then, you know, as soon as Tracy turns him down, you know, she just takes his hand and, you know, oh, come on, you know.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. She's like a grown up Dinah. I mean, she knows she's very smart. She's very, you know, hip to everything. She knows what's going on, you know.
And as an actress,
She would worry about them being together if she weren't getting married the next day, you know. It's like she's pretty cool. She's pretty old, you know.
And she's a good photographer, so she's like self-sufficient on her own as well.
And was married before to Joseph.
Yeah. I like that detail that they throw in. She is no virginal goddess or whatever. She's she's had some life experience.
Well, the other thing is if Macaulay had just shown up on his own, you know, they're supposed to be friends of Julius's, and one friend of Julius shows up, I don't think it works as well. She's kind of the wedge or the entree. So the two of them together are a little more comfortable than just Mike showing up by himself. And she interacts with everybody. She interacts with Uncle Willie. She interacts with Seth. She interacts with C.K. Dexter Haven. You know, it's kind of like they're a duo, even though he's the dominant character. You know, he needs a girl Friday to get the doors open.
And the actress herself also just has wonderful comic timing, and just every read has great little zazz on it. There's one small little line that I've had in my notes, one of my favorites, and I don't even really know why, where it's right after she reveals that she had been married to Joe Smith Hardware, and Jimmy Stewart says, "You're the darndest girl." And she just says, "I think I'm sweet."
Yeah, I'm sweet. Yeah.
I just love that line.
Yeah, all of her line readings are really perfect. I think the casting in this movie is amazing from top to bottom, which is my opportunity to segue into my hot take, because the story that Judy mentioned that I would have told too about originally Hepburn maybe wanting to get Tracy and Gable for the parts of Mike and C.K. Dexter Haven, I think it's easy to imagine Tracy in the Jimmy Stewart role, very easy. Of course, as a Tracy Hepburn fan, it would be terrible to think that he didn't get the girl in the end. But more to the point, Gable would have been a terrible C.K. Dexter Haven, in my humble opinion. Discuss!
I wholeheartedly agree. No notes. I was going to say in my notes, actually, what I would have been very interested in seeing, which is not what you're asking, but Joseph Cotten played the part on Broadway. And while this was a year before Citizen Kane, so he had no real screen experience, but I would be very interested in seeing a Joseph Cotten version of that role, because he's got that same sort of acidic, biting, sarcastic screen presence, but it's definitely a different flavor than Cary Grant's. And that would have been I bet that was a very interesting take to see.
Well, they got together a million years later in A Delicate Balance. So, you know,
true.
Right. They did.
I don't think Gable would have been convincing as old money Philadelphia.
No, you're right. Yeah.
I think he could be like an industrial. He could be George. I mean, that might have worked.
But I have to say, loving Tracy as I do, I don't think Spencer Tracy could have been any better than Jimmy Stewart. I think Tracy would have been maybe more gruff. That seemed to be his go-to place sometimes, and you know, had so many you know, he had so many layers to him, I think. He wasn't, you know, he could be the cynical, you know, reporter and this guy looking at the, you know, looking askance at the upper classes. But then he could be sort of emotional and soft, and he could be funny, and he could, I mean, one of my favorite things is when he, when he's drunk with Dexter toward the end, when they're writing that thing, and he, Dexter goes to the door and he stands up and he looks at the, whatever's mounted on the wall, you know, above the, what's an animal head that he just, I just think this was like perfect casting. And the, but even in that, probably the most romantic scene in the movie, I think, when they're dancing around the little pond there. Mm-hmm. I mean, apparently he and Kate Hepburn always joke that, you know, they said that they were like sort of the least likely romantic leads. Yet that scene is like so perfect. And then, of course, it goes into an argument.
Yep.
You know, but it doesn't end in an argument. You know, it's just, right. I think it was perfectly cast.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you that he's perfect. And I think the saying about Tracy that he would have been gruffer is true. I also think there's a way in which Jimmy Stewart, because he's put in this mainline environment, especially toward the beginning of the movie, he's a little bit wrong-footed, and he deals with that to some extent through quips and through going back and forth with Liz and sort of checking their notes and going, are you feeling about this the way I am? And I feel like that would have been the hardest part for Tracy, because Tracy almost always feels like he's comfortable in his own skin, and Jimmy Stewart managed to be able to do that thing where he's both uncomfortable in his own skin, and he either gets more comfortable as the movie goes on, or it's not annoying because it's part of the charm of the character. And yeah, I agree with you.
I could never see Tracy saying the hearth fires and Holocaust line.
I guess I'm thinking Woman of the Year time, because that's Tracy at his most romantic with Hepburn, and I'm sort of, you know, running back from one to the other. But I'm not saying I have no issue with Jimmy Stewart being at all. I think he was
great. And not
great.
To put too fine a point on it, but also I think Tracy would, I honestly don't know what his actual age was in that era, but I think he would have played older, which I think doesn't work as well for that character. That character is still supposed to be relatively young and eventually wants to be a writer.
He was about
writer.
40. Tracy's about 40. Jimmy Stewart's probably, what, 35, yeah. Something
but
like that.
But also, like, I always felt like Tracy, regardless of his age, always, you know, he's a little more grizzled, I guess, shall we say. and genuinely played a little older, at least to these modern eyes of mine, than Jimmy Stewart. And I think that worked in his favor in this role.
What else? What points have we not talked about or that people want to make sure we do before
clothes.
We go?
Clothes.
Oh, my God.
Clothes. Oh, yes. All right.
It's like we
Annette,
always have
please
to talk
lead
about
us
in
a discussion of clothes. I always leave it for last. I don't mean to,
okay.
But I always do.
I have a question. I have a genuine question, because I'm not, while I am not a great clothes horse or super knowledgeable about fashion in general, is there anyone who ever wore a suit, specifically a double-breasted suit, better than Cary Grant ever?
No.
I say no.
And you know
probably
what?
Not.
You know what? My father was a tailor. He was the head fitter at a company called J Press, which is an old Ivy League men's clothing store. And at one point in time, Cary Grant was a customer. And my father, when their tailors went on strike, took his tuxedo home and was sewing it at a kitchen table. And it was a gorgeous tuxedo.
Man.
So I agree. I mean, I thought you were going to say, when we're talking about fashion, I thought you were going to talk about Hepburn, and then you segue into Cary Grant.
And I figure we'll get to her.
But let's talk about Cary Grant.
A good suit, though, is all about the tailoring.
Yeah.
Yeah. I saw that the dress, the you know, the party dress at a costume exhibit. It's still mostly intact, and it still looks pretty terrific.
What is it? Is it white or is it?
No, I'm assuming that part of it is age, but it's a little, it's not white. It's, like an off-white or cream, and the and mm-hmm. it's gold beading and
beautiful.
Oh yeah, I just googled a picture of it. It's gorgeous in color, actually.
Well, and her mother has a beautiful gown on too that has like sort of, I don't know, the ripples and flows of it. And I was, I don't know, and just like so much of the tailoring and the fit. And everyone had very different feels because Katharine Hepburn's clothes were much flowier than everybody else's. And Liz's were very tailored. And then, yeah, so it's just, but all of them are just so beautiful.
That, and that robe that she wears, it's very much like a Greek column.
Her, like the world's nicest beach cover up.
Yeah, the drape of that thing.
Her bathing suit.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Anyways, I watch these and I'm always one of them. When so things, but also just. And I like hats too, because like Liz has one of these hats that's just perfection. And you just can't, we don't wear hats like that. And you just can't get away with it in the same way.
You know, there aren't that many hats in this movie, are there?
There must have been a popularity at the time of, you know, the little like sort of cap that she's wearing when she's in the library. That's I think that's one, and I
it's sort of like a bonnet.
Barbara Stanwyck wears that same thing in another movie that I can't think of at the moment. But it must have been like a.
I think she wears it in Ball of Fire.
Does she wear it in Ball of Fire? Yeah,
Juliet cap taupe thing. Yeah,
I don't.
Yeah.
I never have. I have terrible memory for fashion, which is note to self: always invite a fashionista on the show to get me out of trouble in these cases. Because we watch Ball of Fire for the show as well.
I just like them.
Okay, well, I meant it in a good way. So,
I just want to shout out the music, because if you hear the theme song, you know that it's the Philadelphia Story, and then just the little song that's played when they're dancing by the swimming pool. It's just perfect. It's upper class. It's evening. It's the kind of music you would hear being played by the orchestra at a ball. If you think about Sabrina, I think there's a lighter touch to this movie because Sabrina tries the same thing, but it's the 50s and the music just seems a little bit heavier at that point. But this is just a perfect match of score and scenery.
I also loved the little touch of the fact that he's singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Oh, that's a great touch.
Yeah. Yes.
With Cukor having just been on, at least for a brief while, I guess, on Wizard of Oz. Prior to this. And
well, the joke I made to my husband was, well, at least they didn't have to worry about music licensing because it's all in the same MGM family.
Oh, can I say one more thing about the fashion? It just occurred to me. You know, I worked with someone who actually saw the play, the original. And he said, well, first of all, the party scene dress was, of course, different. It was Valentina, and there was a red, there's a sort of, I call it red, but there must be a better fashion term for that color. Meryl Streep would probably chastise me for not calling it, you know, I don't know what.
Scarlet?
But scarlet, yes. But and he said that when she walked on stage in it, like the audience gasped. It was so beautiful. And that robe is currently, it belongs to the collection at Kent State and has been shown at various exhibits of her costumes. But the other thing, which I thought was really interesting, is she told this to my colleague had interviewed her a number of times, and she told this to him that the platform shoes that she wore in the party scenes, she wanted the platform, like the front of the shoe and around the, so I don't know the terminology, just around the edges of it to be jewel encrusted so that the audience from way back when she was drunk and she was stumbling, they could see her feet stumble. She wanted it to be a physical like manifestation to show that she was, you know, a little tipsy. I just found that very interesting character thing that actors think of, you know.
So just because you said that about knowing somebody who'd seen the original play, I get to tell my play anecdote. No, I didn't see the original play. When I was a new classic movie and new Katharine Hepburn fan in my late days of high school, I did a project of the history. I grew up in Austin, Texas, and I did this project about the history of Austin. And so I went to the Austin History Center. And I don't think it was media specifically, although we have a Paramount Theater that was built in 1915 that was both a theatrical movie house and a place that where touring plays would come. And I found out quite by accident that Hepburn had come to Austin in the tour of the Philadelphia Story. And I just remember just holding that program, the actual program in my hand and going, oh, my God, she was in Texas, for goodness sake. Mm-hmm. which in 1939 must have been interesting. But anyways.
My only remaining shout outs are A, to the word inundo.
Yes. I love that.
Inundo.
Also, you have to raise a glass, as would be appropriate, to Jimmy Stewart's incredible drunk acting in the scene where between him and Grant. It's just wonderful. And I had not really realized until this last watch through again, it's basically two takes, or the vast majority of it, from him sort of coming in the front door to them going over to the table and sitting down and then continuing the conversation sitting down. Like, that whole first half is one take, and then most of the second half is one take, which is I love old movies that were able to have the patience to stay on a good performance like that. And also the most realistic hiccuping I think I may have ever seen in a performance. And there, you can read in the, you know, the IMDb trivia that he sort of came up with that on the moment. And, you know, if you believe it, that he almost broke up Cary Grant with it. And then Cary Grant just rolled with it and said, excuse me, after Jimmy Stewart hiccuped. But really, it's just, I mean, it's great and it's funny and it's real. And I just love every little bit of it, despite my misgivings about any sexual politics in this movie. I can't help it because everybody's beautiful and funny and smart, and those are important things to me.
It's a very pleasant movie to watch anytime in pandemic times. It's also one of those great sort of classic movies of summer film series. I always associate it with sitting in a beautiful old movie theater with air conditioning, and everything is beautiful and happy for the 2-hour period. Well, I want to thank all of you for joining me for this conversation about the Philadelphia Story. And if you're a listener to The Agents of Smooch, welcome to Lions, Towers, and Shields, and vice versa, because we're doing a crossover.
Yay!
Next time on Lions, Towers, and Shields, we'll be talking about another comedy from a very different era, The Apartment by Billy Wilder. If you're interested in following this podcast and subscribing, you can go to theincomparable.com/LTS. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Lion Tower Shield, because S's cost extra. Or you can follow me personally on Twitter at Shelley, S-H-E-L-L-Y, and follow my guests, whose names will be linked in the show notes, to all the wonderful things they do online, too. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks.